Parataya Pratibodhita Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kritikam Puranam Nina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamrita Varshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvamanusantatami Bhagavad Gita Bhavadvaishini.
Okay, we're on verse 5, but let's chant from verse 4. These two verses go together.
Maya tatamidam sarvam. Maya tatamidam sarvam. Jagadavyaktamurtina. Jagadavyaktamurtina. Matstani sarvabhutani. Matstani sarvabhutani. Vachahante shwabastitaha. Nachahante shwabastitaha. Nachamatstani bhutani. Nachamatstani bhutani. Pashame yogamaishwaram. Pashame yogamaishwaram. Bhutabrin nachabhutastaha. Bhutabrin nachabhutastaha. Mamatma bhutabhavanaha. Mamatma bhutabhavanaha.
Remember from, I'm going to just translate this verse 4 and move right into verse 5, because the two really go together, and we only did 4 last time.
So. We're going to do this Sunday.
Okay. Nacha Matstani Bhutani Pasha Me Yogam Aishwaram Bhutabrit Na cha bhutastaha mama atma bhuta bhavanaha. So from verse 4, maya tatamidam sarvam jagat, this entire creation, sarvam jagat, idam sarvam jagat, this entire creation is pervaded by me. Maya tatam, the whole creation is pervaded by me. By me, who is the, what me? Not Krishna talking from the standpoint of his body, right? But Krishna from the standpoint of himself, the Atma Swarupa. By me, who's avyakta murtina, by my form, which is avyakta, not objectified, not avyakta. Vyakta means it's taken a form. Avyakta, there's no form. It's not objectified. It's Satchidananda, my being, which is self-evident, my self-evident being, the one that is avyakta murti. The form is unmanifest. Matstani, so this entire creation is pervaded by me, by the Satchidananda Atma. Matstani sarvabhutani, and all these beings, I pervade this whole creation, and sarvabhutani, all of these beings, matstani, they abide in me. So this is going to be important. This Matstani Sarvabhutani. All these beings abide in me. Yes. But then he says, Nacha Aham Teshu Avastitaha. But they all abide in me, but I don't abide in any of them. This whole, I pervade this whole universe. This whole universe abides in me. All beings abide in me. But I don't abide in any of them. Then he says, well, actually, yes, because remember the second line here, the verse 4, Matstani Sarvabhutani. Matstani, abiding in me, Sarvabhutani, all beings abide in me. Now he says, Nacha Matstani Bhutani. Actually, these beings don't abide in me. All these beings abide in me, but these beings don't abide in me. Nacha Matstani Bhutani. Then he says, Pasha, imperative, second person singular, Pasha. See, may you see, may yogam aishwaram. May you see this yoga, this relationship, you know, this connection, which is of me. Aishwaram means it belongs to Ishwara. So Ishvara is like this relationship between myself and the creation, you know, look at this connection. Yoga means connection here. Look at this connection of mine, this connection which belongs to me. It's the satya mitya. These whole verses are satya mitya. So look, when he says, please see this, the wonder of this, the ascharya of it, the wonder of this, connection that is of me, of mine. Then he says, so now he's going to say more what it is. Bhutabrit, he says, Bhutabrit, I am the sustainer of all beings. Bhutabrit means sustainer. I am the sustainer of all beings. Nacha Bhutastaha Mama Atma. And myself, we'll talk about this Mama Atma in a minute. Myself, Mama Atma, myself, is not abiding in them. I sustain all these beings, but myself is not abiding in them. And then it says, Bhuta Bhavanaha. And I am the creator. I am the one from whom all of these beings come. I am the Bhuta Brit. I sustain all of these beings. But I'm not abiding in them. Right? So that's the verse. So these two verses are connected. The verses are really the whole crux of the vision. It's the satya mitya. And so that's why we did this meditation. And the whole meditation was satya mitya, to kind of understand experientially, you know, to differentiate your experience so that you can see the satya mitya. Without yourself, so when we do the meadow example, the meadow analogy, the meadow manifests, comes from you. It doesn't manifest within itself. What I mean by that is, before the meadow comes into manifestation, there is no meadow to create the meadow. Now, when the meadow comes into manifestation, what comes into manifestation, this is, I'm talking just for your imagination for now, but notice that this imaginal example really fits the very nature of the creation. So when the meadow imagination comes into being, there's not a prior condition in the sense that there's no time, there's no space, there aren't some grasses that we go and plant. The whole reality, the whole empirical reality of the meadow, right, comes from a state in which the time and the space and the materials of the meadow were not. Right. So the meadow comes into manifestation, is sustained, and the meadow resolves into a state where there's no time, there's no space, there's no meadow, there's no trees, there's no sky, there's no clouds. The whole reality of the meadow collapses into an unmanifest condition. Right? And so now, when I play with this meadow imagination, I notice a couple of things. One is that before the existence of the meadow, I, the conscious being, am. When the meadow comes into manifestation, I still am. This is a viveka that needs to be recognized. When the meadow comes into manifestation, I am. Now, when we say I am means the amness. When I say the amness, it means I am, means I exist. And the existence is not inert. So my being itself is conscious being. That's why we can say this amness is self-evident. It's not self-evident if it's inert. It's self-evident because it's conscious, consciousness. So that's why we say when we're talking about the Atma, we're talking about Brahman, it's Sat-Chit. It's that the consciousness itself is the amness. So the amnes experience, self-evident experience of am. When I say self-evident experience, I mean it's not objectifiable, right? Amnes is its own light. That light, it's lit up, it's self-lit. That is consciousness. So amnes is consciousness, consciousness is amnes. It's not there's some amnes over here and some consciousness over here, or that there's amnes which has a quality of consciousness. It's that consciousness and amnes are one and the same thing. They're two words that are pointing to one swarupa, one nature. And that nature is not something divisible. Why we say sat, chit, why we say these two words is because within the manifest creation, the meadow or this room is fine, there is chit, consciousness, consciousness, consciousness. That's how we think about it. Mm. So whatever, there's 10 or 12 of us in the room. And so here are the little conscious bubbles in the room. And then, of course, there's the rug and the table. These are all is. But we wouldn't say the table is conscious, or the rug is conscious, or this is conscious. And so in our mind as samsaris, as being individuals within the room, or characters within the meadow, we make a differentiation in our experience between conscious beings and inert beings. And so we ourselves, in our own psyche, have divided these two words, because we experience things that don't have consciousness compared to things that do. You know, it's kind of the, use the example of like if I hold up a mirror to the sun and I hold up a rock to the sun, both are equally mitya, equally inert, but this one has a special property: it reflects the sun. This one doesn't. Both are equally illumined by the sun, both are equally warmed by the sun, but one has the quality of reflecting the sun, one doesn't. So within this manifest creation, there are beings, we say, that have subtle bodies. Those beings, because of the sattva, reflect consciousness, as though we use the word reflect. Beings that don't have subtle bodies, like rugs, etc., they don't. And so we say, this is inert, this is conscious. And so we've divided up these two terms. These, everything exists. All of us enjoy existence. It's easy. It is, 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 you are, you are, you are. It is, it is, it is, it is, you. You are, you are, you are. I am. So we got am, is, and are. Right? Just that's the language, am, is, and are. But I could equally say, if we forget the language, that everything is equally. Everything in this creation equally is. But we can't say, from our own perspective, that everything is equally conscious. And so this is what brings about kind of the confusion. I'm a conscious being walking around in an inert world. But we have to look at this differently, because it's not about, we're not talking here about consciousness being a knower. So we'll just put that idea aside. Because when we, even when we do this type of contemplation, when you get down to your own being, it is, and it is self-evident. You are, right, when we're doing this meditation, just differentiating yourself from all of the experiences, you exist, that amness is there, and that amness is self-lit, it's self-evident. It's not performing an action of knowing, it simply is, and it is self-evident. And everything that comes into manifestation in its presence is known. It is, and it is known. Are you with me on this? It's really important, actually, for what I'm trying to make you see here. When we did the contemplation, we brought in the meadow, we brought the meadow into manifestation, and you differentiate your own presence. Your own presence is, in terms of your own amness, and that amness is self-evident. Now, self-evident can be self-shining, self-luminous. It is self-effulgent. It is known without a knower. I can say all of these words are just synonyms pointing to the same self-evident nature of myself. The self-known, I'm going to say now, I'm going to use another little tricky word. The self-knownness of myself. The self-knownness. Self means nothing more. It means nothing more than self-evident. But I'm going to say self-knownness as a synonym. Okay? Now, when the meadow comes in, the imagination of the meadow comes, what does the meadow enjoy? It enjoys isness, and it enjoys knownness. It enjoys my being, which is and which is known. My being is and it is known. It is self-evident. The universe comes into this self-evident being. When the universe is there, it is and it is known. When we're talking about the meadow, we are the Ishwara of the meadow. The meadow is manifest knowledge. It is known. When the meadow universe resolves, what is left? Me. What am I? I am self-knownness. I am, and I am self-known. The meadow is there. It am, and it am self-known. See what I mean? Because your being is not something that you can objectify. It's not objectifiable. You don't say, look at the amness, look at the isness. It is self-evident, non-objectifiable. Non-objectifiable, self-evident means consciousness. I am a conscious being. And so now, this amness consciousness is the Brahman, is the non-dual reality of all experience. And so I say now, for the moment, we'll bring back the meadow. The meadow depends on being. Being, which is the rope of the snake. Right? It depends upon being for its being. My being, the amness, is its being. Amness, isness, arness, whatever word you want to use, is not objectifiable, and therefore there is only one. There's only one amness, or beingness, or existence, because it's not objectifiable. If it's not objectifiable, it's not an object in duality. So there is only one amness, which we can call isness. Isness or amness are referring to exactly the same thing. And that amness is the very being which all things enjoy. And we can say, yes, all things enjoy. It is, it is, it is, it is. There's no exception. Any and all experience, it is. And any and all experience, so there's the non-objectifiable material cause of all that is. It's the satyam. It's what actually is and which never goes through any modification, which is stable because it's non-objectifiable and nothing is ever away from it. So that is my amness that everything enjoys. And everything is. We think of it as an object, but actually the experience is just my being. And everything is known. Everything. And no exception. Anything that comes into being, say just from an individual perspective, now we'll look at Ishwara later, everything that comes into being is known. So look at the meadow. Here I am. Self-evident, you know, amness. Self-known amness, right? The meadow comes, and what is the nature of the meadow? It is, and it is known. That is me. That's why I am the, what we call, upadana karanam, the material cause of this creation. Because I am what is actually here. Because everything else, without exception, comes into amness and goes out of it. Everything. Because everything within duality is subject to constant change. That means everything is two things. Everything in the creation is change, 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 relentless change. That means relentless birth and death. That means relentless coming into being, going out of being. And then you can say, well, yeah, but there's some material cause there, like a clay pot. Not like a clay pot. The pot comes into being, but the clay was there, mm-hmm. right? Comes into being, goes out of being. It's clay is the material cause. Wood's the material cause here. You know? Wool is the material cause here. But we're not saying that. We're saying that, no, in fact, wood is only a name. Table is only a name. And this name itself is made up of many other names, like legs and tabletop and varnish. And then we can look at the cells and the molecules and the shavings and whatnot. It can break names within names within names within names. In fact, if we really get into it, this poor little table. The table quickly loses its tableness, right? And there's no end to that dissection, you know? There's an infinite regress here. You can't get to the end of it. As long as the dissection takes up space, we can chop it further, if it doesn't take up space, it's not there anymore. So then there's not a problem. But what is there is the being, which is continually there from the table to the tabletop and the legs, whatever names we are using, from the molecules to the cells, all of them remain. The isness, the being which they enjoy, even though the table is gone, the legs are. Right? The tabletop is. Being never goes. It doesn't matter how big you go or how small you go. Being just simply is. And not only that, the table is known. The tabletop is known. The table legs are known. Molecules are known, etc., etc., etc. The knownness, beingness, remains constant. And that breakdown goes for absolutely anything in the creation. There are no exceptions to it. What remains is the Satchit, always. No matter as we go dissecting. And who is the Satchit? The one objectifiable me. The objectifiable me. Not the objectifiable. Not the non-objectifiable me. Not the objectifiable me. The objectifiable me is Mithya. Like, do this physical body. This also is a name that can be broken down to names within names within names. So it's not just a body, it's hands and arms and heart and lungs, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, until you don't have a body anymore. It comes into being, it goes out of being. What I'm saying here is that we think that there are things here that have substance. They do all have substance. Every single thing has substance. But the substance they have is the Satchit, is the being, which is me, the being which is self-evident. This here has stability. This universe has absolute stability. That stability is the Satchit. It is changeless, absolutely stable. Nothing can change it, and that's why this seems so stable. Because its substance is absolutely stable. It's non-dual, it's non-objectifiable. Nothing can touch it in any way. But upon analysis of this, it's absolutely unstable, even though it's absolutely stable. The stable, what is stable is the Satchit, is me, is my being. It never wavers in any way. This is totally unstable, but even though it's unstable, the isness continues, and so we don't notice that it's unstable, because the isness itself, the being, is stable. Now, this is nice to analyze in reference to the world, but I really like to use the dream analogy, because you notice this. We can notice it in the meadow, but it's more dramatic in the dream. When you have a dream at night and you are totally involved in the dream, you're a character in the dream or you're the Ishwara of the dream, but what's happening in your reality at that time is the dream. The dream is, and the dream character is, and this is the reality. This is my satyam, this is my world here, my dream world. And now, totally engaged in it, it is, I am, the whole duality is there, and it is it's my reality. I wake up from that dream. This stable dream world that I was in is totally gone. But you know what? The stability remains. You can actually say, when the whole dream, which I was so committed to the dream, was totally involved in it, the dream goes away, and I can truly say, nothing has happened. That is astounding. I'll say, nothing has happened. Because nothing has happened to being, or to me, not in the least. Nothing has happened. The presence of that dream, in fact, was inconsequential. Now, I'm not talking about dream analysis from a Jungian standpoint. That's going back into the waking state and analyzing when you had this dream and, what does that mean? That's very interesting. That's psychoanalysis. That's an analysis, Jungian analysis or whatever. That's different. I'm talking now about when you wake up from a dream, there is no death experience, nor does the loss of that dream world is it consequential? The only thing that you might call consequential is, oh, I wish I hadn't woken up. I want to see what happened. You know, that's like a curiosity. But you probably don't say something like, the dream has exploded. The universe has come to an end. Oh, everybody has died. Like we imagine that we're going to say. But there's literally, that's really the experience of satya mitya. That's why I like to use the dream. It's this, the meadow is good too, but that is the satya mitya. Satyam is the reality. Nothing happens to it. It is never touched or changed in any way. And it is the stuff, the truth of all experience, not just my mind, not just this body, it's the satyam, the truth of all experience. And so like the dream, this reality, say if you compare the dream world with this waking world, they're perfect, both are the same. In terms of the order of reality, from the standpoint of Brahman. From the standpoint of Brahman, there is the changeless self and the mitya world. Changeless self, mitya world. Changeless self, mitya dream world. It doesn't matter if this is a dream world and this is a then and this is Ishwara, or this is the objective Ishwara, this is the subjective. My dream is the subjective Ishwara. This is the objective Ishwara. From the standpoint of Atma, of the self, the relationship is exactly the same. From the standpoint of the dream and the waking world, we can say, well, you know, I am, as a jiva, I am existing in this waking world, in this waking state, in this empirical reality that we call Ishwara. I am part and parcel of Ishwara. Absolutely. And so when I dream, my dream is taking place for me as a jiva, who am existing within Ishwara.
True.
So, from the standpoint of empirical reality, your dream is a smaller mitya. Right? It's a smaller mitya. It lasts less, you know. It lasts for less time, you know. It is my little Ishwara projection and not the whole empirical reality. So Swamiji will say, sometimes he'll say, this is just a bigger, longer joke, he says. This is a smaller one, less time. But that's not true. There's no problem there. But the point is that the relationship of the Atma to the dream mitya or the Atma to the Ishwara mitya is exactly the same. Because in both cases, the satyam is what is actually there, and the mitya is that which depends upon what is actually there. That's what mitya is. That which totally depends for its being on something else is called mitya. The thing which it depends upon for its being is called satyam. The satyam, the truth, what is true, doesn't depend on the mitya. Right? For the satyam, what is really true, the presence or absence of the mitya is absolutely inconsequential. Because in truth, the only thing that is there is the satyam. And so what is mitya is inconsequential because it's not a second thing. Like for instance, if I use the clay pot, the pot, right, is mitya. It has no being at all apart from the clay. So we can say now, this pot depends for its being, right, on the clay. It is pervaded by clay. Right? This is why Bhagavan says here, actually none of this is true. That's why he says, they don't abide in me at all. He says, and after saying all of this about abiding, actually they don't abide in me at all. So let's see what he means by that. So if you say, this pot, the pot totally depends upon the clay. The clay pervades, right? The clay pervades the pot. You know? It supports the pot. It's the one from whom the pot is born. You know, it's the Bhuta Brit. It supports the pot. It's the one from whom the pot is born. You know? But then he says, but it doesn't abide, but I don't abide in the pot. The pot doesn't abide, the pot doesn't abide in me. Says, why? Does the pot abide in the clay? Does the pot abide in the clay? You can't say that. Because there's nothing there but clay. There is no pot to abide in the clay. There's only clay. And so like that, here, there is no universe to abide in Brahman. There is only Brahman. Right? But there's a pot. And there's a universe. But is there anything here that has a reality other than potness to the clay? Try to find it. And so I'm going to say, fine, show me. All you have are what he calls namani, namni, namani, namni, namani. Namni means in the name, names, in the name, names. So you have namni in the name, namani, names. They're just names in the name. Now take one of those names. Same thing. Namni in that name, namani. Like for instance, you take table. That's namni in the name table. There are names. Tabletop, table screws, you know, table legs. There are names. So of these names, okay, let's take one. Let's take table leg, the leg. Now that becomes the namni. And now in this leg, what are there? There's varnish, etc., etc. You have to go down into molecules and quarks, and it doesn't stop. Okay? So whatever name you take, the same thing ad infinitum. Well, go on. It's an infinite regress. Name within names within names within names. So find a thing that can be, have a substance. Find a substance other than being itself. And that's why when you say, when Swamiji used to say forms within forms within forms, he gave that up and just went to names because there are no forms. But there are names, right? Forms within forms within forms, but you can't really find that form has more of a sense of substance than name does. So you can just say, you know, there's just an infinite number of names for Brahman. Infinite number of names for Brahman because there's nothing else here. But that can't be intellectual. It can be intellectual, but we're talking about liberation. We're talking about recognition, you know, of my being. Differentiation of my being so that I can recognize in this names within names within names within names myself, which is Satyam, the self which is Satyam, which is non-objectifiable, which is changeless, which is absolutely infinite, boundless in nature. That's the name with Ananda. To understand Ananda, Satchitananda, I am conscious being, which is, sometimes Swamiji uses this word, which I like, conscious being, which is absolutely unencumbered, means there is nothing limiting my being. Nothing limiting me or shrinking me or creating any stress or tension in my being. It is limitlessly unencumbered me. That's the Ananda. Now, if that Ananda was sorrowful, that would be awful. I am such a sorrow, you know, limitless sorrow. But we never have that experience. We have the experience of sorrow. Sorrow is an experience within duality that comes and goes. But your being is not an Ananda which comes and goes. It's the me which is stable, you know, stable. The me that is stable. Is by its nature full and complete, and there's not a word for it that we can use other than Ananda. We use Ananda because it is the most sought after. You know, it is the most sought after. But I need to recognize what that word means because the word has been taken over within empirical reality, by experiences within duality, like happiness and joy and bliss and fullness, you know, supreme bliss, or the all of these words have taken over the word ananda, but all of these words come and go. They come into being and go out of being. They're not the self that is always present. The self that is always present, there's nothing more desired than my own being. It is the beloved. It's what all of the mystics refer to as the beloved, or the one that is most dear. And so that, when we do this viveka, you know, the viveka between myself and these objectified experiences, sometimes in meditation we can ask, why am I, why do the rishis, or why do the mystics, why do the Upanishads call me the most dear, or ananda? Why is the silent presence of myself, why is it called ananda? Then you ask, is there anything I love more than this, than my own being? I'm not talking about thoughts or moods or emotions coming through the mind. I'm talking about the stable being of yourself that illumines all experience. Is there anything more dear to me than that? And if you say yes, then I would say, well, what is that? What is that? Mm-hmm. It's my happy experiences. Would you rather have you or your happy experience? I'd rather have me. Because then at least I'll be here to have the happy experience. I'd rather have me. Really? Why would you rather have me? Maybe it's a miserable thing. It doesn't matter. I'd rather have me. You know, you should sit with that me and see how absolutely beloved it is. Then, because this, to me, this recognition is a huge recognition. Once you recognize it, once the mind sees that, then there's a fullness. There's a resolve to whatever the problems are. Because no matter what is going on, no matter what maturity my mind needs to go through, and all of these things, all of those things are there. Getting rid of the complexes, getting rid of the bad habits, getting rid of the reactions, getting rid of the, you know, likes and dislikes, and I need this and I need that. All of that stuff that we've had for lifetimes, and so that all has to work itself out. Mm. All of that is working itself out in a stable self, which is ananda, and which is the very being of the whole creation. And that's, so for starters, take the stable self, which is ananda. That's a huge thing. And then from there, we have to see that stable self, which is ananda, is the self of the whole creation. And here, so let's just read this verse again, what Krishna says, because he's talking about himself as Brahman, as the Atman. He says, I pervade my being, I, the Atma, the me, the self, whose nature is avyakta, not objectified, not manifest. I pervade this entire creation. And all these beings, all beings, they abide in me. They exist in me alone. Then he says, but I'm not in any of them. You know, like a pea in a pod. I'm not existing as an object, as something in any of them. Then he says, in verse 5, and all these beings, they don't abide in me. They don't, you know, all of these beings, they don't abide in me. Because if they abided in me, then I would be full of them. But I'm never touched in any way. So they don't abide in me, and yet I'm their Bhutabrit. I'm the one who sustains all of them. Like when you imagine the meadow, you are the being of that meadow. Without you, there is no meadow. So you sustain all of them. So he says, I sustain all of them. But then he says, and not only that, I'm the Buddha Bhavanaha. I'm the one from whom, you know, everything comes. The whole creation comes. Just like from you, the meadow comes. From me, this entire creation comes. I'm the source. I'm the one from whom the whole thing is born. And yet myself, when he says Mama Atma, myself, what he means is, talking here with as Krishna within the creation, talking from the standpoint of this body, mind, sense, or it's like if I say my Atma, I'm talking from the standpoint of the Upadi, myself. It's not that the self has another self. He's just referring to the self from the standpoint of the body-mind sense organ. So he says, but myself is nacha bhutastha. Myself is not abiding in them. Right? Myself is not bhutastha, existing in them. That's why I can be, I am, and each one of us says this, I am the self in all beings. If I was abiding in any one being, you know, like my heart is abiding in this body, and your heart is abiding in your body, well, myself is abiding in this body, yourself is abiding in that body. That's not the situation. There is one self. There is one self, which is the self, which I am, and which you are, and which you are, and which you are. So when each one of us says, I am, the mind says, I am. The amness, the being that is being referred to, is the same being that Krishna is talking about. The same being, which is the being of the whole, the amness, the conscious being of the whole creation, or the conscious being of every individual in the creation, you know? The conscious being which is Ishwara, and the conscious being which everything within Ishwara, every jiva within Ishwara enjoys. So it's like if you have, you know, 100 mirrors, you know, each one, you know, reflecting the sun, and each little mirror says, you know, I'm the sun, I'm the sun, I'm the sun, I'm the sun, I'm the sun. Okay? But there's only one sun. So like that, there's only one me, so I couldn't know you more intimately than I know you. Because I am you. And I couldn't know Ishwara more than I know Ishwara, because I am Ishwara from the standpoint of the self. The self that I am is the self that Ishwara is. And then from the standpoint of the whole upadi, the whole manifest, infinite manifest creation, this body, mind, sense organs belongs to Ishwara. When you have an imagination of the meadow, those meadow characters, meadow trees, meadow birds, meadow sky belongs to you, the meadow, the one from whom the meadow has come. They all belong to the meadow. All of this, this body and everything here and everything in the entire creation belongs to Ishwara. No, it's like Ishwara's limbs. I can say, well, this hand belongs to this body. It doesn't have its own little thing here. It's part of this whole. So everything about you, everything is part of Ishwara and taken care of by the whole. And you are the self of the whole. So you are Ishwara. That you are Ishwara. Of course you are Ishwara from the standpoint of yourself. From the standpoint of the body, you're part of Ishwara. From the standpoint of the mind, you're part of Ishwara. From the standpoint of you, you are Ishwara. The same way I can say, I am the meadow. The meadow comes from me, is sustained by me, resolves into me. I'm the meadow. There is nothing here in the meadow other than me. The meadow, though, is mitya. Right? The meadow is mitya. But the meadow doesn't belong to anybody else. Right? But the meadow has no being apart from me, and I'm not changed by the meadow. So that's, I'm the Ishwara of the meadow. But I'm also I am Ishwara from the standpoint of the whole. Because there's only one self, that's why. And I'm not located in this body, mind, sense organs. So it's like a pea in a pod. You think, I am located here, and so how could I be Ishwara? I am here. But no. This I that you are, right? There's nothing away from it. So that's what needs to be understood, and that's the satyam mitya. That is really the vision. That's the vision of Vedanta. It all resolves into the satyam mitya. It has to be seen. Let's stop there. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamadachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Harihi Om.
What do we do with this sense of division or feeling like there's two? I mean, that exists in...
Well, there are two. Like, there's 10 people in this room and there's many objects, but it's mithya. You know, like, you have to be able to say, if you have the meadow imagination, there's many things in the meadow. If you have a dream, there's many things in the meadow. But what is the truth of it? Can you recognize the truth of it? Can you recognize your presence? You know, in reference to the meadow. Can you recognize your presence in reference to the world? See, the one thing also to realize, I think it's helpful. Any thought, if you think of a thought, like say if I were to close your eyes, say, close your eyes and imagine this room. Now you're looking at the room, right, with your sense organs. If I say, close the eyes and imagine the room, then you have a thought of the room, right, a memory of the room. And you can say, oh yes, I'm the self of that thought. I'm everything in it, right? I'm the self of everything in that thought. That's easy. But if you open your eyes and you have a thought that's being generated by sense perception, it is still a thought.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
But you won't say, I'm not the self of this thought. They're both thoughts. But one carries so much more weight than the other. Even though both are thoughts, one's a perceptual thought in the mind, and one's a memory-based thought in the mind, or one's an imaginal thought in the mind. Whatever the thought is, in reality, the thought is pervaded by your being, because it's just a thought. Right? So what has to happen... So say if you can do that, and just have thought after thought after thought, whether it's perceptual or imaginal or memory-based, and if you can recognize that you are the being, the truth of the thought...
Mm-hmm.
Then that is your experience, because you don't have any experiences outside of the vritti, right? So this is all conditioning. Now the thing is, you can say, well, it's just a vritti, but here, you know, it's solid reality. Well, that's why we have to analyze this solid reality to see that actually there is no solid reality here, right? There's no thing. Say we accept, which we do, we accept an empirical reality, a shared, we're called vyavahara, a shared reality. That's why I can say, do you see this rug here? This is a Persian rug. You know, I love this rug. Okay, so I can go on about the rug, and we can all look at the rug, and that's what we call empirical reality, a shared reality. Right? So it's not that we don't accept that. I'm saying that what we are perceiving is whatever thought modification is there in the mind. That's our perception. Mm-hmm. And some perceptions I can say, some vrittis in the mind I can say, yes, obviously I'm the one conscious being that pervades, that I'm the self, I'm the changeless self of that thought. It's very clear. Or I can do it clearly with dreams, clearly with imagination.
Yeah.
But I can't do it with perceptions.
Yeah.
Even though the experience is exactly the same. Okay. So now, but what we have to do, because it's a vritti, right? But so now what we have to do is, because there's a jump to be made because of the dehatma buddhi. Dehatma buddhi means, you know, I'm the total identification of the self with the body. Deha means body. There's a total commitment, total identity, you know, I am the body. And so now what I have to do is analyze the nature of this reality that's external to the body. and includes the body. This body is made of the same material, right? This is the what we call the waking state, in which the physical body is made of the same material as the out of the same material as the world, the five elements, elementals. So we have to analyze this until, to our satisfaction, really, to our satisfaction, we can say that there is no matter, M-A-T-T-E-R. There is no matter here. There is no substance to be found here. And that just requires analysis, and these are the given prakriyas, you know, that are used to show that there's nothing to be found here that we could call a substance. It all comes down to names within names within names, to an infinite regress. Mm. You know, so there's different prakriyas that have to be used in very clearly to make you see. It's not enough just to break these down. You have to, as you're breaking it down, you have to recognize that something remains that is untouched, and that is being itself. And we say being itself, which is consciousness. And then you have to understand, consciousness is not consciousness of something. And when we think of yourself, you think of this karta bhokta, you're a knower, you're an enjoyer. And when you think of consciousness, when we use the word consciousness as a word within duality, we think of consciousness of something. I'm conscious of this, I'm conscious of that. Or I'm a highly conscious person. Then I'm saying, I'm such a conscious person. I'm sensitive. I'm a sensitive person, and I'm really, you know, conscious and careful. These are just ways that we use the word, I'm saying. And so then I'll even say, yes, I do have some consciousness around that. So I have some sensitivity. I'm aware of that. I have consciousness around that. Now, if I say, you are consciousness, what is that going to mean? I am consciousness.
Different.
I am conscious of something, you know. I do have consciousness around that. You are consciousness. That's not saying you are conscious of something. See, so these words have to be really unpacked so that you get the implied meaning of the word, not just the word that, not using the word like everybody uses it within duality. If I'm a knower, if Atma, if Brahman is a knower, then, and there's only one of us, Atma is a knower and there's only one of us, then I would have to know everything. Mm-hmm. Even Ishwara, Brahman is not a knower. Knowership, this idea of knowership requires the upadhi. It requires that sarvajnyatvam, omniscience requires an infinite manifest knowledge. The whole maya upadhi enjoys knownness. Why does it enjoy knownness? Because that is what is actually there. Knownness is the satyam. Knownness means that self-evident being. You know? That's the truth of it. So whether it's the maya upadhi, the infinite manifest knowledge, that enjoys knownness, or any jiva that has a mind, it as though enjoys knownness, then you can say, well, oh, and the poor rug doesn't enjoy knownness. Well, you know what? Actually, nothing enjoys knownness except for the Atma. Right? It's the Atma that gives the experience of knownness. It is the consciousness itself. So, I mean, that's going a little bit, but don't worry about it. What I mean is, because I thought everyone was starting to worry about that. I can't get away with it. So if I hold up, you know, the mirror and a rock to the sun, both are equally inert, right? The subtle body is sattva. That sattva, sattva, rajas, and tamas, that sattva, as though reflects or allows for the manifestation of consciousness. It doesn't have consciousness itself, right? You have to think of it like this. If you think it has consciousness itself, then there's two things. Mm-hmm. There aren't two things.
So both
there's
are
inert. One thing.
Both are inert then.
You can go like this. Everything is inert or nothing is inert. Like, look, if you take the clay pot, I like the nothingness inert because it's more true. take the clay pot. You know, is the pot, you know, the clay or not? It's only the clay, right? It doesn't have anything. So, in other words, for me to say, oh, the Maya is inert. But there isn't anything inert. There's only consciousness. So it's like saying, for the clay pot, is the pot clay or not clay? You have to say it's clay, right? You can't say the pot is other than clay. So I can't say that this mithya is other than Brahman. Right? It has no being other than Brahman.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, here it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, coming into being and going out of being.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we call it mithya. It's nothing but Brahman as long as it's here. But it can be differentiated from Brahman because it's subject to change, it's subject to birth and death, it's infinitely divisible. You can't find it as you look for it, really. But here it is to be accounted for. We have this shared reality. We can't say that it's not here. But upon analysis, the only thing here is consciousness. Consciousness which is being. You can't find... Because if you say, no, then you have to find, you know, the matter that you're talking about. Give it to me. Just give me one little piece of it. And you can't. Because of all of these logics, you know, that are very hard to squirm out of.
Yeah. Because even the body wants to say that it's here and it's
the source. It's here and it's complex and there's infinite laws that are holding this whole thing together. But same with the dream. Like, it's easy for you to look at the dream in terms of its reality in reference to your being. But within the dream, it can be very complex. What if you're a scientist in the dream? You know? Analyzing the dream. You'll continue to discover the mithyatva of the dream, but it's still all very real because you're made of the same material as the rest of the mithya. Right, the one who's analyzing is mithya as much as the thing that's being analyzed.
And you're not really the mithya anyway.
You aren't. In truth, mithya has no being apart. That's what makes it mithya. But the mithya person is analyzing the mithya object. And the mithya person is made of the same mithya that the mithya object is made of. You know, and there's no way to really step out of that.
Yeah. And we all agree that we're real. All the mithyas.
We all agree.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So when you say there's nothing that's inert, what are you trying to say there?
In reality, that there's no, that this has no substance, no being apart from consciousness. Consciousness is the substance, mm-hmm. is the truth of it. And that's where you continue to land upon any type of analysis. You land on being itself or existence itself. And that is what enjoys the, what do you call it? It is the self of everything. It is the common denominator of all experience. It's a thing you cannot get rid of. Everything else you can get rid of. You can break it down, you can get rid of it, you can turn your back on it. You know. But being, you can't turn your back on.
So sometimes when I think about my thoughts, and I think like, how to say it? And I mean, this may sound weird, but and maybe it's the wrong way to look at it, but almost like they're kind of like transparent. And what's in them is, in a way, because it's consciousness. So I don't know.
Well, the thoughts are transparent. They haven't, for using this, what we've gone through in Vedanta Sara, they haven't gone through that panchakarma. They are subtle. Thoughts are subtle.
Uh-huh.
You know? The world is gross.
Okay.
But now, what I was trying to tell you, though, is that in terms of your experience of this physical world, right, the experience that you have is a vritti.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
The imagination is a vritti. Vritti means a thought modification. It is a thought. But the thought has for its subject matter this physical world that you're perceiving through your sense organs, but you are perceiving a thought. That's why you can recognize, if you just kind of objectify the thought, you know, first you just have the thought and you're just engaged in the thought and identified with this body. But if I ask you to be with the thought in a different way, where you're in a sense recognizing the nature of your experience, you'll see that all of it enjoys your being. Mm-hmm. But you have to slow down. Yeah. All of it enjoys your being. All of it is known. There's nothing apart or away from your presence. If you just slow down, then you can see it in the same way as if you imagine a meadow or take any given thought that is like a memory or something. And that's a really good exercise to do. We're so engaged here and with the Dehabuddhi that our mind is just defining reality for us, you know, rather than recognizing. I mean, this does have an empirical reality. That's why we call it Ishvara. You know, it has an empirical reality. It's not just the subjective reality of my imagination and that type of thing. But whether it's subjective reality or empirical reality, I can still recognize the pervasiveness of my being. And that pervasiveness, that's a tricky word. That's only from the standpoint of the creation that's being perceived, whereas from the standpoint of me, I am the center of the whole thing and I don't have anything to do with time or space. So both things are recognizable. The freedom of me from time and space and the pervasiveness of my being from the standpoint of the creation. So, you know what I mean? It's an interesting one.
So is the practice that, I mean, in practical terms, is any moment we can slow down and actually step out of or see the through mitya in that moment to really break it down and really do the best we can in these moments to just try to see clearly kind of the illusion in front of us.
That's right, and that's why Nididhyasana is so helpful. Nididhyasana means where you just really slow down and do some mm-hmm. meditation, contemplation, so that you can see it very, very clearly. And then what happens is, as the mind gets used to seeing that, then after some time, you always see that. Because it's always there to be seen, mm-hmm. you know? It's just the mind is so used to getting itself engaged as a jiva within samsara. I mean, that's how we've always done it from beginningless time. You know, with that identification with the body, that the mind doesn't even think about anything else. So now everything slows down and so, oh, this is what it is. You see it. You slow it down and you sit with that. And then throughout, as you start to really recognize and see it, then throughout the day, you stop and just notice and stop and notice. And pretty soon after some time, you don't ever not notice. Mm. Because it's not even about noticing. You don't have to notice yourself because yourself is self-evident. It's just that superimposition, you know, doesn't have the type of power.
Well, does the sense of me change, kind of?
No, because the sense of me has always been the sense of you. It's just the superimposition goes away. Mm-hmm. So you've always, the you that you've taken to be you before knowledge is the same you that you take to be you after knowledge. The you of the Ajnani is as much Brahman, right, as the you, the Ajnani means the one who doesn't have knowledge. The one who doesn't have, the self of the one who doesn't have knowledge is the same self as the one who does have knowledge. The only difference is that both of them, the Ajnani and the Ajnani says, I am perfect. I am referring only to Brahman, this body. Oops. the I am part, the self-identity, is perfect. There's only one self. There's only one referent, and that is Brahman. But the Jnani says I am and has that viveka where it recognizes me without the superimposition of the body and the mind and the sense organs and all of these things. That's not there anymore. And once that's not there, then, you know, unless I'm getting kind of lost in samsara, I have to pull my mind back. The experience is this me, that is self-evident in this creation, which is not away from me. And you can still be totally engaged in the world. It doesn't mean you're not engaged in the world, but that is, you recognize that.
Well, your identity is a little bit altered, I mean, isn't it?
In some ways, yes, in some ways, no. Because you recognize, you know, in the 10th man story where the 10th man says, recognizes, oh, I am the 10th man. Well, in that story, he already was the 10th man without knowing it. So the self experience of the 10th man experience was already there without the recognition that I am the experience of the person was there completely without recognizing that this person is the 10th man. Right? So in a way, nothing changes, and in another way, absolutely everything changes, because in the recognition for him that I'm the 10th man, all of the nightmare of not being the 10th man, of the 10th man being drowned, etc., goes away. But there's no new experience of me. Right? So here, there's no new experience of the Atma, or of yourself as the Atma. You always were the Atma, you always will be the Atma. There's nothing happens there. But that you are stable and free and not touched by the changing experiences of samsara or of the creation is totally different. Because the mind had taken itself to be me. And it is always changing. And taking the body to be me, and the body is subject to death. So with the viveka, those notions that have been superimposed on me are not there.
So you stop worrying about the story because you kind of start to understand.
One reason you stop worrying about the story, though, that's a little bit different. First of all, you recognize your instability, but this story is part of a greater story. The kartra tvamboktra from the stewardship and. This isn't necessary. You don't have to worry about it. You know, it's taking place anyway. You can engage in it or not engage in it, but it's Ishwara's story, not your personal story. And so that's very nice. you are a real component of Ishwara's story, and so there's a place for you. And so it's appreciating, okay, this time around, this is the story that I'm playing out here. It's Ishwara's story. Yeah? And I don't need Ishwara to do this, be in this way or that way, because the self is whole and complete. And I'm never away from that, and either Ishwara can't touch that either. Ishwara can't touch the self. Right? So
the attachment is really to the habitualness. In a certain way, you know, it's like this recognition, what you say, it's inconsequential, you know, that's, I think that's kind of nails it in a certain way. What you were saying before, what I really mean is, it's like once you see it, you're just left with the habitual vrittis, and it just kind of spinning
born,
around.
Yeah.
And trying to grab hold on you somehow and suck you back into samsara.
That's why you bring your mind back. That's why you do shravana. Somebody asks, how long should you do shravana? There's a verse where the Swamiji always tells us, how long should you do shravana? You do shravana, you know, again and again until you don't need to. You know?
So I think, like, this may seem kind of simplistic, but that the sort of helping the recognition of the satyam at all times, in a way, that as the sort of ahankara kind of loosens, because it seems like that
ahankara loosens because it starts going home to the self. Yeah, the ahankara shifts from its total identity with the body, mind, sense organs to having the I identify the self, be attached to the self. So, yeah, definitely.
So is that then the question I had was before, like the idea of knowledge and experience? And I don't know if there's a place for that in that, but it feels like to me, so by me slowing down and actually practicing and remembering, trying to reminding myself, it's very much can felt at times as an experience, but often just feels like as intellectual knowledge, which feels very true to me, but I don't have. I wonder if it changes over time in actually like a more experimental, like an experience itself, where you drop the experience of coming home instead of having the knowledge about it.
You see, the experience, it is experiential in this sense. The experience is already here. It's already here. And so it's not about getting a new experience, but about recognizing the experience that's already here. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That's not intellectual. That's recognition. But the self experience, which experience means I'm experiencing it, so that's a difficult word, but the self-evident nature of me, that I am here, that needs to be recognized in reference to this viveka, this discrimination. Right? Because I already am here. This is an experience. Me, I'm here.
Mm-hmm.
This body is here. The mind is here. The sense organs are here. The universe is here. It's all being experienced right now. So now I have to be with this experience that is here and recognize it in a different way, which requires this discrimination. This discrimination also is not just intellectual. It's discriminating what is here. Right? Yeah. In meditation, like in this meditation that we did or at the beginning of the class, that we're dealing with, I'm using words to describe what is here. So say, you know, if you're just listening to the words and the words aren't landing on what they're pointing to, then that's intellectual.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're listening to the words in a way that or let the words point and describe your experience, then that's recognition.
Mm-hmm.
The words are being used to recognize something. And that's experiential.
Mm-hmm.
You see the difference?
Yeah.
That's important. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Good.
Father, when you speak about the analogy of the snake on the rope.
Yeah.
Is that like identifying with the body mind?
With the snake on the rope, the reason we use that is to show the satya mitya, where it makes it very clear in that analogy that from the standpoint of the rope, there is no snake, and the snake, in fact, doesn't even touch the rope. The snake can't do anything at all to the rope, and the rope doesn't go through any type of modification or change to become the snake. We use that example along with clay pot. We need both examples. Well, the problem with the clay pot example is that clay, you know, we mold it and we move the clay around to become the pot. And so you'll think like that. Well, there's nothing there but clay, but the clay has transformed itself, moved. Still keeps its clayness, but it moves into the form of the pot.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And there's a pot maker that's doing all of that. But so you need the rope snake, because the rope snake shows the maya. You know, the snake is maya. And it doesn't touch the rope. Right? It's not like the snake is lying on the rope or doesn't touch the rope. And so that's, we use rope snake and clay pot to show the satya mitya of the creation. Now there's another way we use it on top of that. And that's when we use the rope snake to show how the maya, the snake, can cause so much sorrow and suffering. You're walking along, you see the snake that's really nothing but a rope. You see the snake. You know, Swamiji tells this story with such detail. The boy walks along and he sees the snake and then he feels it, you know, bite it. Because his foot rubbed up against, you know, the rope, as it had these little prongs sticking out. And so then he, in all misery, thinks he's been bit by a rattler. His mind just goes, you know. And so he goes through all the suffering and everything. Because what he saw, even though it's maya, what he saw was a snake. And so he responds and reacts to the snake. There's nothing there but rope. Like here, there's nothing here but Brahman. There is no Ananda out here to gain or to protect. There's only Brahman. But you're seeing it differently. And that ajnanam, ignorance-born vision, you know, creates so much suffering. And that's why when you gain knowledge of the rope of Brahman, the cause for the suffering is gone. Right? Because what you were seeking out here within Maya is really the nature of your being, the very source, right, of what you're seeking is your being. And so, and that being is secure. The love, the wholeness, the fullness, everything you seek is has for its swarupa, has for its truth, the self. And the self you can't lose. Nobody can take it away from you. Nobody can improve it or make it worse. Nor can you, which is another huge relief.
And there's no gradients of
self. There's no gradients, and there's no feeling that, you know, I'm going to blow it, and myself is going, I'm going to sully myself, and then it won't be so full anymore. You can't do anything to it. You can't make it better. That's also a huge relief. You can't shine it up or improve it, and you can't make it worse. It is. And it is you, and no one can do anything about it. No one can touch that. That's the moksha, you know? But it is that self that's superimposed on the creation, and then we run after it. And unfortunately, everything in the creation is away from me. It's subject to change. It's subject to death. It can leave. It can change its mind. It's a nightmare.
So I'm a little confused. So when you say the self is superimposed...
Onto the world...
I thought superimposed meant that, like, when there is a rope there, then I put a snake on top of it.
No, well, that's true also in terms subjectively, but you have to use it in different ways. That example, like, so if we say superimposed here for you as ajnana, from ignorance, you will say, it is. All of these objects exist. All these people exist, right? That's a superimposition of existence onto the object. Because then you'll say, all of these people exist, and one day they will die. It's true. All of us will die. All of these forms, names and forms will die. But the being won't. But we superimpose beingness and, you know, conscious being onto the object, and then we say, so conscious being is going to die. If I say that all humans die, that means I'm going to die. I have superimposed conscious being onto this body. So conscious being, the conscious being that I am, is going to die because the body dies, because all body dies. All bodies die.
It also looks like existence dies.
Exactly. Existence, though, for that's relevant to you, is your amness, which is the only existence there is. And then you said the amness and the body are one. The body dies, therefore I die. My being dies. All beings die. You know? That's superimposition. Now we're talking with the rope snake, one more thing. When we're talking with a rope snake, sometimes we're talking about the power, because we can use the rope snake for a lot of different things. It's very juicy in that way. Another way that we use the rope snake is your projection. You're walking along and you see an object, rope, without seeing that it's a rope, right? So you have the experience of the three bends and the diameter of that thing lying there, but you don't see it as a rope. You just see the form. And on that form, which you haven't seen as a rope, you project whatever could fit that form. And so that could be a snake or a water streak or whatever. That takes the projection because it's a trigger for that projection. So now here, in terms of me, the conscious being that I am, the mind has ignorance. It has ignorance and it has conscious being, right? Because the mind enjoys conscious being, but it's also self-ignorant. And so therefore the mind says, it projects the conscious being onto itself. I am the conscious being. And it projects itself onto the conscious being. I am very labile. It means I'm emotional and I am like this and I am like that. That's all projection. You know, the mind projects itself onto conscious being, and it projects conscious being onto itself. That's what we call mutual superimposition. It's called anyonya adyasa. You know, and the reason it can do that is because it doesn't know conscious being. It doesn't know what it is. You know, let me be more clear. It has what we call samanya jnanam, general knowledge. I am a conscious being. Everybody says that. But it doesn't have this vishesha jnanam, particular knowledge. The conscious being that I am is Brahman. Doesn't know that. Is limitless. It doesn't know that. Just knows I am a conscious being. Plus ignorance. That's the condition of the mind. Because I am a conscious being.
But how can the mind say it's a conscious being?
Because how can the pot say it's clay? Because it is a conscious being. But the satyamitya is like this. The mind is consciousness, but consciousness is free of the mind. Right? The mind has no distance whatsoever from consciousness. Its
right.
being is consciousness.
Right.
But consciousness is free of the mind. So the mind is consciousness, but consciousness is free of the mind. That's the satyam mitya. Because the mitya has no being apart from the satyam. So the mind has to be consciousness. Because there's nothing else there. So the mind is consciousness, so why wouldn't it say I'm a conscious being? It has to say, and it can correctly say, I am a conscious being, but the conscious being that I am is free of the mind. So the mind says, I am the conscious being, but the conscious being is free of me, of the mind.
I tell myself that every day. You know? I mean, you can tell yourself that a lot during the day.
Well, it's good to tell yourself that as you're seeing the truth of it.
Yeah.
And if you can say that, just a momentary meditation just to see the truth of that until you don't you never not see it. Until it's just that superimposition has been taken care of. And what keeps bringing it back, you know, is all of the leftover habitual behavioral patterns. Mm. Based upon ajnana, based upon ignorance. And so it takes a while for the mind has to keep rising up with its ignorant habit patterns into your buddhi. Buddhi means into your knowledge. You know? It keeps rising up and rising up into your knowledge, and your knowledge, you know, shines upon it and slowly gets all straightened out over time.
It's like taming a horse or something.
Yeah.
You know,
it takes work
and perseverance.
Perseverance.
And awareness.
And then finally the horse says, okay, I get it.
And in terms of projection, is there another part of that too where we project separation onto Brahman? Like, we project that all these objects exist separately.
Yeah.
But they actually don't, really. They're just existence itself. I mean,
I could say the rug is different from the chair. Mm-hmm. It's separate from the chair within the confines of duality.
Mm-hmm.
But the being of the rug mm-hmm. is not separate from the being of the chair.
Right.
There's only one being there.
Right.
And so in that way, like if you use the example of take a bass, big hunk of clay, rectangle of clay, and there's a bas relief carving of a scene in this huge rectangle of clay. You know, there's all kinds of objects in that scene, but there's nothing there but clay. So you can say, well, the right is different than the left, and this object is different from this object, but in reality, there's only one clay there. And since there's only one clay, everything within that bas relief is totally interconnected. Right? It's just one thing, really, comprised of names within names within names. But there's a connectedness. It's infinitely interconnected. Right? So there's science, you know. There's an infinite discovery of the interconnectedness of all things. Because it's only one thing.
But then can there be a kind of like a switch in a sense of like, what are you looking at? Or that's not the right word, but it's like, is your attention to the clay or is your attention to the objects? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, that's why, you know, yourself is self-effulgent, self-evident. So it's always abiding there. Your mind can be focused on this or focused on that or focused on this or involved in this. But in that involvement and engagement, you are always present. And both are equally there, right? And so the one is not covering the other, you know, unless then one is never covering the other, really. But I mean, even from the standpoint of the mind, one appears to be lost. The recognition of self appears to be lost, but that's because the mind has become very engaged in samsara, really, in itself, in its emotions, in its reactions. It just gets pulled out to see. Gets pulled out to see, and then you have to throw it a life preserver and pull it back, you know. Then it goes, oh. Like there's some... Swamiji talks about this in one of our dialogues that we have here. Where he's talking, he said, what wins? What is going to win in terms of experience, your knowledge, you know, or the ajnanam? Say you're jnani, you have knowledge. But then you get lost in samsara because of some lack of vairagya here or there. Something just pulls you out and just go through this whole trip of samsara and you're suffering and everything. Then, who's going to win here? Is the samsara going to win? Or is your knowledge going to win? They say, your knowledge will always win. Because the mind can't keep it up, you know? It can't keep up anything, you know? And so, it'll wear out on its samsaric adventure. It will wear out.
Exhaust
itself. And then when it gets exhausted, finally, you know, and it can be a wild ride, but when it gets exhausted, then what is still there? It's my knowledge. And my knowledge will say, wow, that was really...
Where did I go?
What happened?
Yeah, what was that about?
Intense. That was really intense. It's nice to be home. So that's a really nice little art... Not argument, but unfoldment. He does that really nicely. But it's a very important one. Yeah.
So what happens to jnani with Alzheimer's disease?
It doesn't matter, because it means the body is not functioning anymore. Right? So the brain isn't functioning. And so, in a way, it's like saying what happens to a dead body. You know, this physical body is not functioning anymore. And so the body has to die. It's like what happens, like,
but there might still be realization, right? Because
the realization isn't hurt at all. But if the mind isn't able to think one way or the other,
yeah,
the self is self-abiding. The self doesn't think. The self just
right.
is.
Right.
But see, say like with an Alzheimer or a coma or brain dead, for instance, which is just a severe form of. Something like that. Then, what is the experience of the rug? The rug isn't having an experience at all. Right? But the self isn't dependent on the rug, it's not dependent on the rug, it's not dependent on the brain, it's not dependent on Alzheimer's or the lack of it. It makes no difference at all. And the mind also, once ignorance has been removed, ignorance has been removed. But now this upadhi, this physical upadhi, isn't functioning anymore. And so from its standpoint, there's basically nothing happening. Do you understand what I mean?
So satyam is happening, but there's no recognition of satyam, really?
Satyam is self-evident.
Yeah.
Right? But there's the mind, there's no... If you say there's no recognition of satyam, there's... not recognition of anything. There can just be kind of in severe Alzheimer's, there's like the continual flow of memories.
Yeah.
Without, it's like a dream state It's like a dream state in the waking. It's interesting. I know, because my dad went through all that.
You know, I work with people with Alzheimer's dementia, and I noticed over the years how to handle this particular lady. So what she does is, like, she'll have like a memory going where she lives and everything, and when she decides that she's going to find where she lives,
uh-huh.
I mean, her clothes will be in the middle of the room, and what I learned over the years is, like, instead of trying to hold her back from that,
yeah.
from the craziness she's creating, I let her do it. I'll say to her, I said, well, where do you live then? That way. And eventually, I mean, if I don't get worn out, you know, but she will get worn out. She will drop it because the mind just, you know, the mind itself just got tired.
Yeah, and it took it on its own journey.
Yeah,
right.
And she let it play out instead of trying to stop it, you know, and stuff like that. And then she's quite present, actually. Mm-hmm. You know?
Oh, I do know. And that's in good places, you know, homes where they take care of these. That's how they deal. That's how they do. They let them be like, do what they want, live in the reality that they want, as long as they're not hurting anybody. Mm-hmm. And my dad was a doctor, and they gave him his stethoscope and all kinds of things, and he used to go around and take care of all the patients.
Yeah,
the whole thing, and they were fine with it. You know, and the patient, the other Alzheimer's patients were fine with it too.
Very entertaining.
Yeah. They all did their own thing, and they were supported in that.
Yeah,
there's a police. With a lot of respect, also.
Yeah.
You know?
There's a police chief there, Fairfax, and
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
I go like, hey, you know, the other day we needed more manpower, you know. And he'll go like, yeah, yeah, and then he goes back into his, you know. But,
yeah.
Yeah, it's very fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it was interesting when I was taking with my father. I actually lost any kind of fear or anything for Alzheimer's. So interesting, because it is what it is. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they're doing whatever, they're doing their thing in it. You know, it's
and it also helps, you know, for me to see that that's the mind.
Yeah, that's the mind.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's so predictable in a way, you know, because, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
Mind's the mind. Oh, let's call it 9:30. Let's call it a night. Hi, Terry. Hi, Virginia. Hi, Nella. Hi, Catherine. I didn't see you there earlier. All right. I'm going to... Catherine. Oh, Jagadish.
A lot of people online tonight.
Yeah, there are a lot online. That's good. It's a good class.
Yeah. Are you going to post it?
Yeah.
I ran out of memory. I finally ran out of memory.
Oh, you did? Oh, I said, yeah, I'll post it.
Okay, right in the middle of it. So I will.
Okay. You got a ride,
yeah.
Journey. Good. Oh, good.